This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in September of 2021.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. On her 120-acre homestead high in the Colorado Rockies, writer Pam Houston learns what it means to care for a piece of land and the creatures on it. Elk calves and bluebirds mark the changing seasons. Winter temperatures drop to 35 below. And lightning sparks a 110,000-acre wildfire, threatening her century-old barn and all its inhabitants. And in her book, her memoir, Deep Creek, she tells us about this and how the ranch becomes her sanctuary, a place where she discovers how the natural world has mothered and healed her after a childhood of horrific parental abuse and neglect. Pam Houston's author, in addition to Deep Creek, of Contents May Have Shifted and Sight Hound, two collections of short stories, Cowboys Are My Weakness and Waltzing the Cat, and a collection of essays, a little more about me. Most recently, with Amy Irvine, the book is Airmail, Letters of Politics, Pandemics, and Place. Pam Houston, pleasure to welcome you back to Access Utah. Thank you.
Thank you for having me back, Tom. I really enjoy your interviews.
So for those who don't know your story and the Deep Creek story, I wonder if you could, maybe we could start there. I think it's worth recounting.
Sure.
How did you end up on this ranch?
Well, I was in graduate school, in fact, at the University of Utah, in creative writing, working on my PhD, and I was just about done. And my dissertation at the U was the collection of short stories, which became Cowboys Are My Weakness, and I was lucky enough to sell it to W.W. Norton for $21,000, which to me at the time as a graduate student who was earning about $4,500 a year as a TA seemed like an immense amount of money. It seemed like maybe more money than I would ever have. And when my agent gave me the check, she said, "Don't spend it all on hiking boots," because she knew me and knew knew what I was apt to do. And so I took that advice very seriously, and when school was over, I got in my car, and I drove around the West looking for a place to put that money down, a place to call home, which I had never really had in my life, and I looked lots of places, Idaho and Utah and Wyoming and Montana, but I wound up in this little town called Creed, which the writers Antonia Nelson and Robert Boswell had told me about. They said, "Check out Creed. We heard it was cool." That was the big recommendation. And I got to Creed after looking at property all over the West, after giving readings in tiny independent bookstores in mountain towns all over the West, which are still the people who sell my books. You know, that was when I established those relationships. And I got shown this ranch, this beautiful 120-acre ranch in a valley, in the Rio Grande Valley, the upper Rio Grande Valley, ringed all around by 12,000-foot mountains. It was the most beautiful piece of land I'd ever seen. It also happened to be the third week of September, as a matter of fact. So you know what the aspen trees were doing at that altitude, which is 9,000 feet. You know, it was the most beautiful moment of a beautiful spot of the year. And the ranch, I had this $21,000. And that $21,000 represented just about 5% down of what the asking price of this ranch was. And the price had just been reduced. And I was just out of grad school. I didn't have a job. I was starting a new book, but I hadn't sold it yet. So I basically had no income. I was more or less living in my car, and this ranch was the money I had in the world, was about 5% down. And the realtor said about Donna Blair, who was the widow who was selling the ranch, she said, or he said, the realtor said, I think Donna Blair is going to like the idea of you. So why don't you give me a copy of Cowboys Are My Weakness and your $21,000, and I'll see what I can do. And a few days later, Donna Blair sold me the ranch for 4.7% down and a signed hardcover of my book of short stories. And she carried the note herself, most importantly, because nobody in the world should have or would have lent me the money. So she carried the note, and she believed in me for whatever reason. You know, we hadn't met, but she read my book, and I was very young and fresh out of grad school, but I thought, well, if she believes in me, maybe I can believe in myself. And, you know, it has turned out to be the biggest decision of my life. You know, I have since spent the last now almost 30 years growing up there and being responsible to something and making my payments no matter what. And, you know, learning about fire and ice and all those things you mentioned. So it was a kind of crazy thing to do that turned into the story of a life.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that part of it. The realtor says she's going to like the idea of you. What do you think that was? What do you think that would have appealed to her?
Well, I think a woman, you know, she was a strong woman. She is a strong woman. She's still alive. She's a strong woman. She had a mysterious job, Donna Blair. I used to say, you know, what's new? And she'd say something like, well, I just got back from Yemen. And I'd say, what were you doing there? And she'd say, oh, this and that. So I don't know. I think it appealed to her that I wasn't afraid to live at the end of a 12-mile dirt road at 9,000 feet. I think she liked the fact that I was an artist. I think she liked the fact that I was a single woman who wanted to be as close to the wilderness as I could. I can't really say. I mean, I guess, you know, where I come from, which is New Jersey, I think she thought I had chutzpah. And I did, in fact. She was right about that. Because over the next many years, I had to learn how to do a lot of things. I mean, I did grow up in New Jersey. I thought water came out of the wall, you know, hot water. Like, I didn't understand really how anything worked. And so I had to learn about sweeping my own chimney and fixing my own fence and giving animals shots in the middle of the night and, you know, when they were sick and all kinds of, you know, the things I didn't know. I say in the book, the only thing longer than the list of the things I didn't know were the things I didn't even know I didn't know yet. You know, it was a very steep learning curve.
And probably good you didn't know some things before you went in, right?
Yeah. Right. I might not have gone for it.
Yeah.
I mean, even at the time, I recognized it as a kind of insane thing to do, but I was a bit of an adrenaline junkie back then. You know, I was a river guide and a hunting guide. That's how I was making my living in the summers during graduate school. And, you know, I loved whitewater and I loved, you know, skiing out of bounds and all those kinds of things. And I think in a way, buying the ranch, I mean, I'd like to believe some inner wisdom spoke, and maybe it did. But I think part of it was just, okay, this is a crazy thing that I'll never be able to pull off. So let's try it, you know.
So tell us a bit about describe the ranch. It's 12 miles down a road, pretty isolated, 9,000 feet. That's up pretty high.
Yeah, the pasture is 9,000 feet, and then the mountains, which of course are not on my property, rise to 12,000 feet around it. As I found out in the fire during the West Fork Fire, which was the largest fire in history in that quadrant of Colorado in 2013. You know, it's really in a meadow, and it's fairly protected from fire because it sits out by itself. There are aspen trees on the border of the property, and then of course there's lots of spruce trees that climb the mountains. But my property is mostly meadow, mostly pasture, and it has a little creek running through it, and the Rio Grande touches it in the front of the property. So it's ringed around by these protective mountains. It's very nestled in a corner of a giant park, which has, you know, four or five other ranches in it. Most of which, including mine, are now in a land trust. So they're protected and they won't be subdivided. It's just a beautiful bend of the Rio Grande River, with 12,000 foot mountains all around it.
What kinds of things did you have to learn? We talked about this before, but as a refresher, and you write about it in Deep Creek, there a lot of things you didn't know, right? maybe select right. a couple, two or three things that, practical things that you had to learn.
Well, one thing I had to learn is, I was there about 3 years, maybe, and someone came to visit and said, "Now, when was the last time you put that UV protector on your log?" And I was like, "Well, okay, check UV protector." And sure enough, at 9,000 feet, as probably a lot of your listeners know, if you don't coat your logs, if you live in a log house and you don't coat your logs every year, or roughly every year, they start to the solar, the UV starts to eat them away. So I learned that I have to, put UV protector on every log every year. And that's a funny thing, because if you buy that, my life became trips to the hardware store, multiple trips to the hardware store for one task. What I learned is, usually about the third time you go to the hardware store, you get the right thing. And the funny thing about the UV protector is that it says it can't be put on if the temperature is going to drop to 40 degrees within 24 hours, which is almost never the case where I live, because at that elevation we get under 40 almost every night of the year, or if it's going to encounter dew or frost or rain. So it was just one of these funny things. It was like there was no way to follow the directions, but my solution just became to slap on a bunch of UV protector and hope for the best. And there were many, many things that fit that category. Sweeping my own chimney was a challenge, because we don't have any chimney sweeps in any of the counties near me. Raising Icelandic sheep, who get up to a lot of trouble. They're the wildest, sort of hardiest sheep. They're good at fending off predators, but they like to ram things. They like to break things. So learning how to manage my rams in my Icelandic sheep herd, that was a whole, that could be, many years of an education. There was just so many things. I mean, honestly, we could spend the rest of the hour with me talking about things I didn't know how to do.
Yeah.
And that I had to learn.
I wonder, for a New Jersey girl coming out west, and I think you've said that you immediately fell in love with the West. Talk about that before we talk about, I want to have you talk about the specific place, your ranch, but talk about the West in general. What is it about the West that appealed to you?
Yeah, well, that's definitely the case. I came out first before graduate school. I lived in Winter Park, Colorado. I was a ski bum after college and worked about 7 jobs so I could ski 100 days a year. And I just fell so in love specifically with
Well, sounds like we've lost Pam Houston. Let's go to a break, and we'll get her back on the line. The writer Pam Houston, author of Deep Creek and many other books. More with Pam Houston following this break.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in September of 2021.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Our guest for the hour is the writer Pam Houston. She's author of the memoir Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. A couple of novels, collections of short stories, including Cowboys Are My Weakness. She teaches in the low-res MFA program at the Institute of American Indian Arts and is a professor of English at UC Davis, co-founder and creative director of literary nonprofit Writing by Writers. And she lives at 9,000 feet above sea level near the headwaters of the Rio Grande, and we've been talking about her place there. So, Pam Houston, we've got you back on the line.
Yes, sorry about that.
Okay. So before the break there, you were talking about growing up in Jersey, coming out west, and the appeal of the West.
Yeah, I was just about to say that it was honestly the Red Rock country of southern Utah that blew my mind, and I've written about this a lot in earlier books. It was you know, I love the mountains. The first place I saw when I came out west was the Wind Rivers in Wyoming, and they were gorgeous. But when I got down to southern Utah and saw the canyon country, I just couldn't, like, it sparked something in my imagination. And I thought, you know, you could just set people down, set characters down here, and, you know, amazing things would happen to them. You know, I feel like coming out west in a certain way made me a writer. It opened something up in me. I mean, I was obviously writing before that, but it opened something up in me that I wanted to bear witness, and I knew the landscape would help me. You know, like it was just a click. It was an artistic click in when I saw on southern Utah, and that's why I decided to go to graduate school in Utah. And but also, you know, the mountains of Colorado and the whole Four Corners area, all of that. It just felt like the place I was meant to be, you know, and I have that feeling. I've been lucky enough to travel around the world, and I have that feeling when I get set down in certain, I would say, like, young, arid mountain ranges and canyons. I remember the first time I got to go to Tibet, and I landed in the airport at Tibet, and it was that same feeling. So it was just like, oh, I'm home, you know, and the mountains are very similar to the mountains of, you know, the desert Southwest. And I just think, you know, whatever, I must have lived lives in the desert Southwest before, or there's something about the quality of the air and the sky, but something just makes my whole body relax when I'm there.
Your ranch, 9,000 feet, we've had you told the story of how you came to purchase that, less than 5% down. How quickly did that become home?
I think very quickly. I hadn't had a home prior to that. You know, I do talk in the ranch about my childhood home. My parents were both alcoholics, and my dad was violent, and he broke my leg when I was 4, and I spent that year in a body cast. And so I never felt safe at home. You know, there were good things about my parents. There was good things about my upbringing. But I certainly never felt relaxed or safe in my childhood home. And, you know, you heard when I was describing the ranch, it just felt so safe. It feels so safe even as I describe it now. I describe it in the book as this, like, lucky horseshoe of mountains keeping me safe, and that's how it feels. I've got the river on one side. I've got the mountains on three other sides. I've got all that beauty all around. I mean, I don't know that it ever didn't feel like home. I mean, I think for the first 10 years, I was so afraid I wasn't going to be able to pay for it that I was afraid of losing it. But that's not the same as it feeling like home. You know, it really feels like the place in the world that I am at ease. I mean, I'm sort of a type A. I'm kind of a workaholic, but when I get there and I sit on the porch and I can look at the mountains, like I said, it's just some kind of anxiety or tension just drains out of my body. It's really, really good ground. You know, it happens to be beautiful, but it's also just ground that's full of positive energy.
How important was this place in healing from trauma? You do talk about this in the memoir, right?
Yes. Well, I think it was very important. I think it was very important to feel like I had a home that I was in charge of, where I called the shots, you know. And, you know, who did I call the shots for? Well, me and my dogs, you know. But you know, just that was mine, that every decision was mine. And I mean, one thing about Creed, because it's in the middle of nowhere, you know, I've had therapy and I've had healing, you know, acupuncture, body work, all those kinds of things. And I have to kind of travel for those because we don't have a lot of that in Creed. But the ranch itself and nature, you know, I mean, at some point I realized that even as a little kid, in the absence of good parenting and good mothering, I really did turn to the earth. You know, I, even back in New Jersey and back in Pennsylvania, I would take walks in the woods, or when we went to the beach, I would say goodbye to every wave for like an hour. You know, like I was always looking to the natural world, be it the ocean or just a walk in a flower garden or a walk through the woods, as a place of solace and a place of comfort and a place of healing. And even to this day, if I am really sad, like several times during COVID when I lost people that I know, I'll go outside and I'll just curl up under a tree and just feel the earth, you know, just feel the ground. And that really feels comforting to me. And I think I did that as a very young child. And I did it all the way through my childhood, where I would kind of let the ground, let the earth, let a tree, you know, comfort me. And I mean, that may sound a little woo, but it's really what I do. You know, it's because I really do feel like I was mothered by the natural world. And that became ever more evident to me when I moved out west and moved to the ranch.
This has been a through line in your life. I think your mother apparently would say, "I don't want to see you until dinner," right? And so you'd be out.
Yeah.
You'd be outside, yeah. Which I guess was not a bad thing for you. You enjoyed it.
No, that's how I end the book. And I really mean it in a nice way. You know, like I really do. Like, I mean, she never wanted kids. And she was adamant that I not have kids. And I haven't. I have taken her advice. She hated being a mom. And she was upfront about that, which I guess in a certain way is, you know, better than pretending. I've thought a lot about that. But she did say, you know, every day, "I don't want to see you till dinner." And the last line of the book is, my mother always said, "I don't want to see you till dinner." And with those words, she freed me to go out and love the earth. And that's the truth. You know, I mean that in the best way possible, because she did, you know, and I'm always happy outside. I'm always comfortable outside. I always feel, you know, like I'm home when I'm outside, really, no matter what the landscape is. And in a certain way, that's because she didn't want me around, and she sent me out, and I went and found spots that felt good. And I've been doing that all my life.
And still do, I expect.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
I want to have you react to something that I've seen you say this a couple of times, you know, it's more than once. Let me just quote you. Mm-hmm. If you live long enough, you quit chasing the things that hurt you, and you eventually learn to hear the sound of your own voice. Mm-hmm. You could expand on that a little bit. And how does that happen?
Well, I mean, I think for women, especially, I mean, I should just talk for myself, but I do think, you know, menopause is a thing that makes you hear your own voice. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of life stages, and I notice this in my friends, but it's certainly true about me, where we're trying to please, we're trying to please, we're trying to please. And then all of a sudden, you know, you get to a certain age. I mean, I'm going to be 60. I'm going to be 60 in January. And I feel like that's a kind of accomplishment in the world as it is. And and at 60, you know, I feel like an elder, and I feel like I want to tell young women, you know, what you think matters, what you feel matters, what you believe matters, what you say matters. I mean, a big part of my life right now is about mentoring young writers, both men and women. I teach, as you mentioned, at the Institute of American Indian Arts, so mentoring voices that haven't been heard as much as they should have. And all that's so important to me, to say your story matters, your story matters. You know, there's a lot of questions about the state we're in with COVID and the climate, and, you know, does art matter anymore? I think it absolutely does. I think stories matter. And I think by expressing yourself, however you do that, in my case, it's writing, and in my students' case, it's writing, you learn to hear the sound of your own voice. You learn to hear what matters to you. But I do think as a kid, because my dad was such a tyrant, you know, I was really socialized to not even know how I felt, you know, to not even know whether something felt good or bad. And so that was just a long process. And I think my time in the natural world, and then my writing about my time in the natural world, was an incremental set of lessons in believing my own thoughts and feelings, and my own ability to know what I'm doing here or how to make a meaningful life.
Tell me a little bit more about your students. Do they come in wondering if their story matters? Is that something you'd have to talk to them about?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all of them, no matter where they're from. I think doubt is a writer's constant state. I don't know very many who that isn't true about. And if it is, you know, they might be kind of jerks. I think it goes with the territory, you know. But I also think, we lost Barry Lopez this year, and he was such a big influence on me, has been my whole life. And he always said, we're pattern makers. We writers, or we artists, are pattern makers. And if our patterns are beautiful and true enough, they'll have the power to bring a person for whom the world has become chaotic and disorganized up from their knees and back to life. And I think about that every day. I think about that quote every day, because I'm always looking for pattern and structure in my own work. But I also think so many of my students, especially the ones who have come from violent or chaotic places in their early lives, which a lot of them have, I think they're looking for pattern. They're looking for a beautiful pattern, you know, in which to tell their story. I mean, that's just one way to think about a novel or to think about short stories. And I think, you know, that patterning, that taking chaos and making it beautiful somehow with language, you know, I think that's it's like a miracle and a gift and an opportunity and a privilege and an honor, you know. And so that's what I'm trying to help them do. I'm trying to help them find the form that will make their story tellable.
How did you navigate that as a young writer? I guess you come out with you have to have some ambition, right, to even go into this. It's difficult to get your work out there. How did you navigate those things as a young writer?
Well, this sounds like a circular conversation, but I always just trust the natural world. So for me, my process of writing, this has been true since the beginning. I move through the world trying to pay really strict attention to the things that arrest my attention. And for me, because I spend so much time outside, these are often natural world things, right? A seal, or I'm actually in right at this moment in at the end of Cape Cod, and we saw these crazy sunfish yesterday. We were out in a little boat, you know, so that was just a thing that arrested my attention. But whatever it is, you know, whether it's the color of the light on the river, or whether it's the sun coming through the aspen trees, or whether it's a funny t-shirt in a window, or whether it's a conversation overheard in a coffee shop, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't have to be the natural world. It's just where I am mostly. But I collect those things. I call them glimmers, kind of a weak word, but that's what I've been calling them. It's the basis of my teaching. And I call them glimmers, and I collect them, and I put them in my computer. And I have, you know, tens of thousands of these glimmers in my computer. And then when I have time to write, I just kind of paw through them and see which ones want to come out and which ones might want to stick together and make a story together. And, like, you see, that's the pattern making. Like, it's like taking these good quality raw materials. I tell my students it's like going to the farmer's market, getting a whole bunch of organic vegetables. And then when you come home, you can hardly screw up the soup because you've got all your good organic vegetables. You've got all your good glimmers. And then you see which ones want to go together. And the reason that I do it that way, rather than like a more traditional outline or thinking about the aboutness of the story, the reason I do it with the glimmers is because I want to invite my subconscious into the process. You know, I want to invite surprise into the process. Like, what happens if I put orcas and fruit bats into the same story? And sometimes amazing things happen, you know? And so that is my method. And that's how I did it starting out. A story of mine, which is called The Best Friend You Never Had, which wound up in Best American Short Stories of the Century. It's a story I'm really proud of. I wrote it when I was quite young. that is all glimmers. It's just all these little pieces of a couple of years that I was living in Oakland, California, stuck together. And it made the story that wound up in this anthology, because I think there's authenticity in letting, you know, letting your glimmers, or letting the pieces of the world that were meaningful to you, assemble themselves without the writer over controlling them.
Let's take another break. We're talking with Pam Houston, the writer, and she is author of several books, the memoir Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country, two novels, Contents May Have Shifted, and Sight Town, two collections of short stories, Cowboys Are My Weakness and Waltzing the Cat, a collection of essays, A Little More About Me, and the latest is a series of letters between Pam Houston and A.B. Irvine. It's collected by Torrey House Press in the book Airmail, Letters of Politics and Pandemics in Place. And we'll have more following this.
This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in September of 2021.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. We're talking today with the writer Pam Houston. So, Pam Houston, let me just read this from you. This is from Deep Creek. You say, "Motion improves any day for me. The farther, the faster, the better. On a plane, a boat, dog sled, a car, back of a horse, a bus, a pair of skis, in a cabbage wagon, hoofing it down a trail in my well-worn hiking boots. Stillness, on the other hand, makes me very nervous." That surprises me a little bit. I guess I have a stereotypical view of you, you know, out on your ranch, meditating, you know, out in the wilderness, being comfortable, being still. It resonates with me, kind of this, it is difficult. There are difficulties being still. I wonder if you could talk about this juxtaposition.
Yeah, well, I think that paragraph goes on to say, like, whatever improvements I have made in the ability to be still department, I owe to my ranch, you know, because it's such a wonderful place to sit. But I'm not good at stillness. I'm a lousy meditator. I always say, you know, oh, I can do walking meditation, you know, but I do believe, I mean, for one thing, the ranch is so physically challenging, you know, at certain times of year, it's almost impossible. At certain times of year, it takes 3 hours to dig to the barn. Now, with climate, it's a little different. You know, it's gotten a little easier to winter at the ranch because of climate change. Then, of course, we worry about fires on the other side. But you know, one of the things about the ranch is it's so physically demanding. I have about 20 animals, roughly, between the sheep and the horses and the donkeys and the chickens and the dogs. And so just getting them cared for and getting the things that break at the ranch fixed, you know, all of that leads to wanting to sit on the porch for an hour and look at the sunset. Whereas in a more academic life, for instance, when I'm out at UC Davis teaching and I'm using my brain all day, it's not so necessary, you know, to really be still and take a rest. But if you have an idea of me as like a peaceful meditator, you have the wrong idea, because I wish I were. I wish I had grown into that. I have learned many things in my life, and I am getting a tiny bit better at sitting still, but it's just not, you know, I'm hungry for experience, and I'm hungry, as you read, to be moving through a landscape, especially, you know, on a horse or in a boat or on a dog sled, and seeing places I haven't seen. And the ranch has not cured me of that. It's wonderful to have both. It's wonderful to have a place I can be still that I'm in love with. And then it's also still wonderful for me to go and explore. And I say that, you know, after being home a lot in the last 2 years, like many of us have been, you know, I'm hungry to go explore now.
Tell me about that. How was that? Kind of a long stretch during the middle of COVID. were the travel that you loved was, I guess, probably at a certain point cut back to zero.
Yeah, I didn't really go anywhere in 2020 at all. I drove down to Santa Fe occasionally, which isn't that far. It's about 4 hours from Creed, and I have an older friend there that was really isolated. So I would go down and sleep in her driveway in my car, and we would eat on her porch, like 10 feet apart. And I did that a lot, load up on groceries and go back to Creed. But other than that, I didn't go anywhere in 2020. And, you know, it was, I mean, I felt very privileged. I felt very lucky. My teaching went online, all of it. So I didn't really lose any income. And I was able to be home. And it had been many years since I had been at the ranch every single day in a year, you know, to see, like, when do the bluebirds come back? When do the wild iris come up? You know, when does the first leaf change? You know, when is the first snow? All of that. You know, I was there when the sheep got sheared. I was there when the hay arrived. I was there. I was there for every single ranch rite of passage in that year. And it was good to do that because I've been working a lot and traveling a lot prior to COVID. And so I hadn't gotten to do that in a long time. So it really was like a deep reconnection with the ranch.
So connections with others, that changed during the pandemic, right? You had to take precautions, you know, even though you were able to see your friend. For example, exchanged letters with Amy Irvine. You know, I think this is old-fashioned mail, right?
No, we actually...
Was this email?
We sent them by email.
Okay. You know, okay.
The picture on the cover are the crows carrying our letters back and forth across the Continental Divide, or the ravens. But no, we did send them by email because there was a time limit on it. But we didn't write them as emails. We wrote them as letters, you know, offline and loaded them, which is just to say they were taken seriously as letters. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't just dashing off emails. But yeah, Amy and I were asked by Orion Magazine to write to each other for a series they were doing called Together Apart, where two writers who did not know each other were asked to write letters. And we were the first pair in the series. And we started to write letters to each other. Amy lives on the other side of the Continental Divide from Creed in Norwood, Colorado. And by the time we got our 3,500 words written for Orion, we were forging a friendship and establishing a relationship and a kind of a sisterhood. And so we decided to just keep writing. And we weren't really writing at the beginning with a book in mind, but we were definitely finding connection and holding each other together and, you know, speculating about what the world was going to look like and what COVID was going to mean for so many things, including the environment, because we're both environmentalists, in these letters. And then all of a sudden we had 35,000 words. And that was when we thought, hey, maybe this is a book. And that was when we approached Torrey House Press.
I want to read this. This is from the early in the book, one of the early letters. March, end of March 2020. So the very beginning of the pandemic. And this is what you wrote. For all the suffering, heartache, grief, and economic catastrophe this virus will cause, I can't help but wonder what reevaluation of our priorities might come out of it. So what do you think? More than a year later, have there been some lessons learned on your part or that we collectively maybe have learned or you hope we do?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. It feels like it's sort of going in two directions at once. I mean, one thing we learned is that we can work from home, and I think that will become increasingly important, you know, as fossil fuels diminish. I think those were good lessons, you know. I miss the classroom, and I'll be in it in a few weeks back at UC Davis, and I'll be glad for that. But I think there's a lot of commuting, which can become telecommuting, and I think that can only help the general state of the world. But I also think we learned how many people don't believe in science. And I think that was a hard lesson of the pandemic. I know for myself, what I learned was how much to appreciate things that I may have been taking a little for granted before the pandemic. You know, when your life gets really busy, you tend to not notice, you know, how wonderful it is to sit down to a dinner with four of your closest friends, or how wonderful it is to see the ocean, you know, just to name one thing, to be able to just get on a plane and go see the ocean, or to, you know, to go to hear live music, you know, these things that I can remember on the weekend of March 6, 2020, I was in Moab, in fact, with a private writing group, and I had a reading down there at Back of Beyond, and we were kind of giggling. We were like, oh, is this the last time we're going to ever get to eat in a restaurant? Ha ha. And then it was. It actually was. And I think, you know, I think I do. I think I'm full of appreciation for getting to do those things now, and whatever it is. And you know, I'm still being very cautious, and I'm still masking inside, you know. I don't think that we're out of it. But I do think, you know, being vaccinated, getting together with friends, the things that I've been able to do, I really, really actively value them. And I think a lot of other people do, too.
I'm curious about the politics of COVID. This is not only a shared public health crisis, it's political. So Colorado is a blue state, but I'm imagining where you are, it's possibly, I'm guessing, a red county. How have you and your neighbors navigated potential differences on views about COVID?
Well, it hasn't been great, frankly. Since you asked, I mean, I was called a name every time I went into the post office with a mask on during COVID. So I just stopped getting my mail. There was very little masking and very, I will say we had, a young man named Isaac Patenkin, who was in charge of the vaccine rollout in Creed. He happens to be Mandy Patenkin's son, for what that's worth. But he took this on because he has a degree in public health. And we have like 77% vaccination rate in our county, or something super high. He was like a miracle worker, because he got people who, you know, were skeptical to get vaccinated. So that was a total Creed success. Also, this summer, our theater, our local theater, the Creed Repertory Theater, had an entirely outside season, and they were actually written up in the New York Times for it. And so that was wonderful to have the theater back after not having it in 2020. But it was tough during the real pandemic. And another reason I went to Santa Fe to see my friend was also to get groceries, because in Santa Fe, everybody masked in the grocery store, you know, and you just felt very safe. And that was not the case in Creed.
I want to follow up, Mr. Patenkin, winning over skeptics on vaccinations. How did he do that? I don't know if you know.
I don't know. I mean, I know that just personally, when I got my shots, he texted me about 1,000 times. Not that I was a skeptic. I was completely eager to get vaccinated. But he was just, like, he reminded people, you know, and they made videos, like, they made, you know, like, funny videos, him and his crew. It was like a miracle. I mean, honestly, like, you know, I would have thought we would have had very low vaccination rate. In fact, we have, I think, the highest vaccination rate in the state. And that's all about Isaac Patenkin.
Wow.
Honestly.
Yeah. Amazing. Coming down to the end of the conversation, I want to have you talk about this. This is from Airmail. Talking about, I guess you could put it under the heading of activism. I'll just read what you wrote. Trying to stay safe, trying to be invisible, can only lead to despair. The only time I feel really okay anymore is when I'm fighting for the things I love, whether it's a student's manuscript or protection for wolves and grizzly bears. Battling for a better world is the only occupation now, and you say it's women's turn to lead the charge, maybe with a few good men in tow. So the only time I feel okay anymore is when I'm fighting for the things I love.
Yeah. True.
Yeah.
I was just talking the other morning with the lady who was making my coffee, and there was Fleetwood Mac playing in the background. And I said to her, every time I hear this music, I think about how naive we were and how sweet the world seemed when these songs came out. But maybe the fact that I was so naive is how we got to all this trouble, you know? And she said, I know exactly what you mean. She said, I don't ever want to pretend, you know, anymore. I don't ever want to be in denial, but we also have to find a way to find joy in the midst of all the things that we're facing, you know? And that's kind of how I feel, you know, I want to fight for the rights of women. I want to fight for the rights of the earth. That seems like the same battle to me. And what does that mean? What does fighting mean to me? Well, to me, it means every time someone asks me to speak, I talk a little bit about the climate catastrophe, or I talk a little bit about what's happening in Texas with women's rights, or I talk a little bit about the voices of my students from Native communities or from other non-white communities that need to be elevated, and those stories need to be told. You know, Toni Morrison said, you know, if you find yourself with a little power, you reach down and you pull somebody else up. And so I have just a little bit of power. I'm a writer in America, and they like me in the West. So in that context, I have a little bit of power. So I want to be sure I'm always reaching up and pulling somebody else up. But I also, you know, I'm ready to fight in 2022. I'm ready to fight in 2024, whatever that means. You know, I have a moderate-sized platform, and I want to use it to try to help the Earth.
Well, we're at the end of our hour. Pam Houston is author of Deep Creek, Finding Hope in the High Country. The latest book is Airmail, Letters of Politics, Pandemics, and Place, the result of correspondence between Pam Houston and A.B. Irvine. Pam Houston, author of many other books. Pam Houston, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Tom. Always a pleasure.
Thanks so much, and thanks everyone for listening to Access Utah.
As the summer starts to tilt, the stars are tipping as well in the night sky. A good time to look up, look around, and get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T here. I took the time the other night to sit in the tiny backyard in Salt Lake City and look above right here in the middle of the night. I viewed Vega, the bright white star at the apex of the sky, making a triangle with Deneb and Altair, forming the other edge of the summer triangle, with Deneb being part of the rich star fields of Cygnus and Swan and some interesting loops and double stars. Using my naked eyes, binoculars, and the 7-inch Burgundy telescope, was able to pick out the coat hanger in the sky. To the left, at a short 45-degree distance from Altair, the shimmering star with two outriggers like Polynesian ocean boats. And a bit later, looking to the east, a bigger orb was coming into view, somewhat tangerine orangish, at around 2 a.m. I suspected that I was seeing a planet, and upon sighting it with the telescope, confirmed the orb in jaunty rings at about a 45-degree angle. Indeed, I had discovered Saturn in the backyard. How satisfying my simple exploration turned out to be. Enjoy our night sky, also exploring the night and day in ancient cultures and right now, such as Stonehenge or many others around the world, including Chaco Canyon and Torrey, Utah. Larry Harper, retired UVU professor who, with the help of many amazing people, has built an incredible structure in the high desert. I'm over here at the Dark Star in somewhere unknown place where the Desert Mystic has built a home. And you were using trees. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
We're going to harvest trees from Boulder Mountain because there had been a fire and we could get a permit and harvest them, any of the ones that were dead. But then it became overwhelming. We realized we would not be able to, because you got to be able to use them, because it takes a long time to get them prepared. So we ended up purchasing trees from the lumber yard here between Bicknell and Lyman. And the foreman that we were talking to, I love this story, the foreman we were talking to was just telling us how much he just loved trees. And he wanted to reassure us that all the trees that they have harvested have already passed away.
You've built quite a place here. It's octagon shape. No, it's not right.
It's an octagon shape. It's two floors, although the second floor is just a loft. So it's open in the center. And the walls, the structure is built with straw bale and plaster. You know, the straw bale's covered in plaster. Most of the windows and the door, the doorways we got primarily from Restore. That's Jimmy Carter's Habitat for Humanity. We're, you know, helping place.
And you are quite astronomically adept, and you have portals for all sorts of astronomical events.
We've got solar alignments. We've got the east-facing windows, some directly going east, so that on the equinoxes we get first light coming through, and the light shines entire, you know, through the window all the way to the west wall. And on the solstices, we've got windows on the southwest, southeast, and the northeast that capture the sunrise there as well. We've got two decks that are on the east side, and one on the direct east right above the front door, and then we've got southeast deck out there as well that we sleep out on. And the southeast deck has a flat stone that has a gnomon, just a rod that goes straight up. We mark solstices, the winter and summer solstice, and the equinoxes, the path of the sun, the shadow that the rod casts on the flat stone, and we mark it.
Fantastic. So we've got a I don't want to say Stonehenge. What would you call it?
Well, before we had the whole structure up, when we first just had the wooden posts, and before we had the roof on it, we called it Woodhenge.
So. Also in space exploration, this from space.com, the European Space Agency launched its brand new Ariane rocket July 9th in the afternoon from French Guiana to send the ESA on new adventures, such as they already have going, like the Solar Probe mission, which is performing close-up studies of the sun and works in concert with NASA's Parker Solar Probe. So keep exploring, look up, look around, and get just a little bit lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.